words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.
Amen.
Today's gospel reading includes what is probably one of the more famous passages from the Bible, from the Gospels in particular. One of the better known passages, perhaps to you, in an older translation, render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and unto God those things that are God's. That particular snippet from Jesus is often quoted. And taken out of context, out of the broader context of this encounter, that particular phrase has been used in a variety of ways. It has been used, for example, to tell Christians that it is their Christian duty to pay government taxes. To pay government taxes. Or as justification for or support for the separation of church and state. There are Caesar's things and God's things. And certainly both of those issues, the question of Christian participation in government, in civic government, and the way in which we understand the separation of church and state, these are both important questions for Christians, very much so. And yet both of those issues are considerably more complex than a one-off quote from Jesus, lifted out of context. As important as those issues can be, it is highly unlikely that Jesus had either of them in mind in this particular setting. So I want to provide a little bit of context for this encounter between Jesus and an assortment of Jews who have come to see him. First of all, I want to remind you that, as you may know, we are approaching the end of the church year, the church calendar, which ends right before the season of Advent, which will start this year on the first Sunday in December. So we're approaching the end of the church year. We start to get sort of year-end themes in the readings this time of year. This also means that we are approaching the end of our journey through Matthew's Gospel, which has been our focus throughout this liturgical year. Jesus' crucifixion is just on the horizon at this point in Matthew's Gospel, at this point in Jesus' story. Things are coming to a head. Tension is building. Matthew tells us in this story that Pharisees and Herodians came to challenge Jesus. These would have all been Jews, but they would have been groups of Jews, Pharisees and Herodians, that would not normally have been colleagues in any endeavor. Rome was, of course, an occupying power at this time. The Roman Empire was an occupying and oppressive power in the lives of the Jews. Herodians were Jews who had basically sold out to Rome, who supported the occupying power, who offered their support to Rome in return for personal reward. The Pharisees, on the other hand, were the preservers of the religious status quo for the Jews, in opposition to Rome. The Pharisees were those who sought to maintain the identity and the religious practice of the Jews, in contrast to the impositions of the occupying power, resisting Rome. And yet, those complicit with Rome and those in opposition to Rome come together in opposition to Jesus. It had come to such a point that Jesus was a profound threat to both of these groups, to the governmental power of empire and to the status quo of the Pharisees and their religious lives. Jesus presented such a threat to both of these groups, to the power of both of these groups, that they worked together to come to challenge him, to trap him, to deliberately trap him. They have no interest in the question that they ask. It is a cleverly devised question, though, one from which there is no good answer. They say to Jesus, "Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not?" No matter how Jesus answers that question, it is bound to have bad consequences for him, and they know that. If Jesus answers, "Yes, it is lawful to pay taxes," Jesus' Jewish followers will be offended and angry and turn away. They will see in that Jesus' treachery and allegiance with Rome, if Jesus says yes. If Jesus says no, it is not lawful to pay taxes to the emperor, he will bring upon the wrath of the Roman authorities, and the Herodians would have been quick to take that news to the authorities. It's a clever trap. But Jesus, somewhat ironically, it seems to me, displays the consummate skill of a politician. He does not answer the question that was asked. He challenges them with another question. In the translation that we have today, he asks those gathered around him, "Whose head is on that coin? Show me the coin that is used to pay the taxes. Whose head is on it?" A better translation would really be to say, "Whose image or whose likeness is on that coin?" Because that's really what the word means, image or likeness. And for Jesus' listeners, who knew the Torah inside out, when Jesus says to them, "Whose image is on that coin?" they would have made the association with the story in Genesis, with the creation story, when God says, "I will make humankind in my image, in my likeness." They would have made that connection between Jesus' words and the words of Genesis. When Jesus asks, "Whose image?" and it is Caesar's, they would have remembered that passage from Genesis where God says, "You are made in the image of God." There's another sort of interesting little scholarly tidbit here, interesting for me at least. The Greek word that Matthew uses, image or likeness, is icon. Icon. In Matthew's Gospel, Jesus says, "Whose icon is on this coin?" Thinking about the passage from Genesis, we might think that God says to the people, "You are made as my icon. You are created, your being, your identity, who you are as human beings is the icon of God." Jesus is saying this lifeless piece of metal is the icon of empire. You are the icon of God. The Pharisees and the Herodians have forgotten. They have forgotten that they are the icon of the living God. Jesus challenges us today, I think, with the same question. Challenges us to remember that we too, as human beings, are created as icons of God. I am not an expert on Christian iconography or on prayer using icons. But you've seen icons. You know in general what they are. And they have always been very important in the worship of Eastern Orthodox Christians, and they are becoming more and more a part of the worship of many Western Christians as well. You may know that those who create icons talk about writing an icon rather than painting an icon. They're not painting a picture. They are writing a story. Writing a story which is meant to involve and engage and draw in those who observe the icon. An icon is meant to invite and draw and engage those who look upon it into deeper truths. It's not just a superficial picture. It's not just a representation of something else. It is meant to invite us into a story, invite us into awareness or engagement with a deeper truth. Icons are not so much pictures as windows. Windows which invite us in, windows which seek to make present in our lives that which the icon represents. Think about what that means if we are icons of God. To be created, to have a part of our created nature, that we are icons of God, made in the image of God. It doesn't mean that we look like God. It doesn't mean that our features physically represent any physical traits of God. It means that we are to be icons to the world, to others, to those who observe us. We are to be windows into that deeper truth, which is God's presence, God's love, God's compassion for the world and for others. Are you a window through which other observers can see the deep nature and presence of God in the world? Do the actions and words of your life, of my life, make present the glory and love that God has for this world and for other people? Are we as icons active in a way that engages others in the awareness and the knowledge of God's love and God's presence? That is Jesus' reminder to the Herodians and the Pharisees and to us, that we are icons, icons of the living and loving God, made present in this world so that we may also share in